We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. Same caption, verdict count two. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count two, third degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. Same caption, verdict count three. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count three, second degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty.
So today, I am relieved. Today, I exhale. But today just marks the beginning of a new phase of a long struggle to bring justice in America.
My feeling was it's very bittersweet because his family, much like a good friend of mine, Sandra Bland, Sandy as I knew her, will never see him again, will never touch him, will never hug him. His daughter will grow up without his father. They'll never see him again. He's still 6 feet under. So justice, in my opinion, will never be served.
That long, hard, painstaking work has culminated today. I would not call today's verdict justice, however, because justice implies true restoration. But it is accountability, which is the first step towards justice.
This is a victory for those who champion humanity over inhumanity. Those who champion justice over injustice. Those who champion morals over immorality.
I'm Jeremy Siegel. This is Politico Dispatch. And today,
I just think that we're still at sort of step one here. We have a verdict. We have some legislation on the table that could easily be passed if Congress works together, but it is not going to solve all our issues with policing and how Black and brown communities are policed.
Bracton Booker on what's next after the verdict.
It did feel like, man, there's no way. There's no way that you're going to convict a former officer for killing a Black man, even though the evidence was pretty substantial and pretty, it seemed like it was a mountain of it. Mm-hmm. And from all different kind of angles and enough witnesses that didn't really have any connection other than they were all witnessing what we now know and can actually say now that was a murder. They were witnessing a murder. But even still, there was that much doubt in the criminal justice system that many people of color, particularly Black people, felt like, well, even though there's mounting evidence, I'm still not convinced that a jury of this former officer's peers is going to convict him.
So with that uncertainty that so many people were feeling, on Tuesday, Judge Peter Cahill announces the verdict.
Members of the jury, I will now read the verdicts as they will appear in the permanent records of the 4th Judicial District.
Guilty on all three counts. What went through your mind when that announcement was made?
It was really shocking. Felt like America, at least in this one instance, had turned like a slight corner of getting towards, you know, some equity. But, you know, when I take a step back, I unfortunately have to remember that this was a single case. Now, an important case, yes, but a single case where there just happened to be several different cell phone angles, cell phone video angles, and also police surveillance angles, and also city surveillance angles that captured this one incredibly horrific moment. And I just think of how many other cases that just didn't have that same kind of technology, didn't have that same kind of modern camera phone, crystal clear evidence showing an interaction between a civilian and an officer that is sworn to protect and to serve, but also has the ability to use deadly force if need be. Mm-hmm. So when officers have that kind of power and, you know, they are being called because in this case, someone is alleged to have used a fake $20 bill to pay for a pack of cigarettes, we have to start to reimagine what it is that we want our police officers to do. We can't expect them to do everything from traffic stops to, you know, domestic disturbance to also deal with, you know, some of the underbelly of crime in our cities, and expect them to be able to apply that training evenly when a lot of their training is to use force, for lack of a better term.
In the aftermath of the verdict, Congressional Black Caucus Chair Joyce Beatty said, This is just
the first step.
And that's a sentiment that I've heard echoed from leaders and activists across the country. You know, relief from the verdict, but also calls for moving forward in the fight for racial justice, the fight to change dynamics surrounding race and violence and policing in America. It's also something President Biden talked about in his address, calling on Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act.
Legislation to tackle systemic misconduct in police departments, to restore trust between law enforcement and the people they're entrusted to serve and protect.
What is the next step here?
Well, I mean, I think that's pretty much the low-hanging fruit, right? Just getting something passed on the federal level, the George Floyd Policing Reform Act, that's already passed the House and still waiting on the Senate to take it up. And this was kind of a needle of by President Biden to say, like, come on, guys, this seems like an easy thing to pick up. And there's now momentum coming after the Chauvin trial.
But it shouldn't take a whole year to get this done. My conversations with the Floyd family, I spoke to them again today. I assure them we're going to continue to fight for the passage of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act so I can sign it into law as quickly as possible.
That seems to be the most logical step, but if we're, again, taking a step back, policing has a lot to do with local jurisdictions.
Yeah.
And while the bill before Congress is a good first step, it doesn't address anything, particularly the militarization of police. It does not change a whole lot of policing tactics, and it certainly doesn't change hiring practices or the inability of police jurisdictions to get rid of this, you know, so-called bad apples. A lot of questions that have come up in my reporting when I'm getting reaction to, you know, the trial proceedings and also to the verdict that we got on Tuesday is, how did an officer like Derek Chauvin make it this far in his career? Because he had a history of complaints. He had been on the force for 19 years, and it took this act to get him fired and then convicted of a crime. And with so many police departments out there, I don't want to make it seem like I am anti-police or feel like all police are like Derek Chauvin, because they absolutely are not, but it's hard to fathom that so many officers continue to get infractions, but then are allowed to stay on police forces, or if they get fired, are able to get jobs elsewhere. And that's part of what the federal legislation is asking to do, is asking to track problematic officers. So I just think that we're still at sort of step one here. We have a verdict. We have some legislation on the table that could easily be passed if Congress works together. But it is not going to solve all our issues with policing and how Black and brown communities are policed.
Last time you and I talked about this case, you said in many ways it felt like America, the nation, was on trial and that race was at the center of it. I mean, that has rung true. This is a case also that's, you know, totally captivated the nation. Everybody was waiting and watching for the verdict on Tuesday. As a journalist who's been covering, you know, every detail of this, and also just as a person, what do you think we're missing here? Like, what are you talking about with your family or your friends or text chains or anything that you think isn't being more widely discussed with this case and with this verdict?
Well, look, I think it was certainly a surprise that the killing of George Floyd galvanized so many people of all races. So many people got behind this particular case, and just finally it seemed like there was a breakdown of a wall to see that, okay, the way that communities of color are police, and the interactions with police are different if it's experienced by someone who's white and someone who's non-white. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think one thing that we're missing here is like the fact that as we are looking at the Chauvin case in Minneapolis, not too far away from when their trial was happening in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, a young black man is killed by a police officer because she says she pulled her firearm instead of her taser. And I'm just like, these split second reactions from police when they're stopping this young man, his name is Dante Wright, because he had expired tags and he ends up dead because of a routine traffic stop. These are the types of things that I feel like we're missing, because what immediately comes to my mind is like, okay, what happens in that case? What happens in the case in Chicago when Adam Toledo, a 13-year-old Latino boy, is shot by police? Police video shows that he had a gun in his hand, discarded the gun, turned around with no gun in his hand, and was still shot. He complied with officers. So again, while much of the nation is celebrating this case with Derek Chauvin and him being guilty on all three charges, I immediately think about these other cases that are not getting as much attention because so much attention is being paid to the Chauvin case, and wondering if the same kind of media attention, same kind of focus is going to remain on those cases. And you know, history tells us that it's probably not, but we'll see.
Bracton Booker, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Also, today, Republican senators are discussing a counterproposal to President Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure plan. Two people who attended a GOP lunch on Tuesday say a plan spearheaded by Environment and Public Works ranking member Shelley Moore Capito on behalf of a group of centrist Republicans would cost roughly $600 to $800 billion. They say the measure would be paid for with user fees and funding left over from the COVID relief package. President Biden has asked Republicans to bring an alternative proposal to his, complete with a way to pay for it, by mid-May. And the White House is weighing a request to send additional weaponry to Ukraine as it faces its biggest military buildup of Russian forces on its border in nearly a decade. In recent weeks, Moscow has built up roughly 120,000 troops along Ukraine's eastern border. According to people briefed on the matter, consideration of the country's request is still in its early stages. The administration has been reluctant to provoke Moscow on the military front and scrapped plans last week to send two Navy warships to the Black Sea amid rising tensions in the region, as Russia has intruded into European airspace, restricted the movement of foreign ships in parts of the Black Sea, and plans to expel nearly a dozen U.S. diplomats in response to the latest round of U.S. sanctions over Moscow's hacking and election interference campaigns. Subscribe to Politico Dispatch wherever you get your podcasts. And to continue to follow Bracton Booker's coverage of policing in America, sign up for the Recast newsletter at politico.com/newsletters. I'm Jeremy Siegel. Thanks for listening.